I can't tell you how wonderful it is to hear people sing real hymns. It seems a great loss to me that the younger people that are growing up are not learning the great hymns of the church. So I'm delighted that in this church they know what a hymn is, and that you all join so heartily in singing those hymns, in which it's so much easier to learn theology. That modern gospel songs are pretty thin on theology, and I learned a good bit of mine through hymns, and that was very painless and effortless. I've entitled my talk, this talk, as Learning to Trust. I was given a lesson in this by my 18-month-old grandson about 8 years ago. He and I were riding with his father in the car, and his father decided it was time to go through the car wash. Little Walter was on the seat between us, and as the car moved into that frightening dark tunnel, the automatic car wash, I could see his eyes, his big blue eyes, got bigger, and he looked at the face of his father. And as the water began to roar and cascade down on all sides of the car, his eyes darted around to the water and the windows on the car, and went back immediately to the face of his father. And then as those giant brushes closed in, which was sort of a science fiction experience for a child that had never been through such a car wash, it's pretty scary for any of us, isn't it, on the first run through. Again, I saw his eyes dart around to the brushes and come to rest again on the face of his father. Now, that little boy was too young to understand what was going on. He had no way of knowing that we were ever going to get out of there. He couldn't see any light at the end of the tunnel, and he didn't know what it was for. But as the car finally pulled out into the sunshine, his face broke into a big smile, and he had never once cried. He didn't know what was happening. He didn't know why it was happening. But he knew one thing. He knew his father. And he knew that his father had never given him any reason not to trust him. Now, Lars has glaucoma. We were told by the doctor when he discovered it about a year ago that there are three kinds of glaucoma, and the kind that Lars has is the kind that nobody wants, the worst kind. And it requires drops 6 times a day for the rest of his life. It's a real nuisance. Not something that Lars ever complains about when I remark on how wonderful I think it is that he's so patient and accepts it without comment, let alone complaint. He says, well, when I think of the alternatives, the only alternative being blindness, then he's willing to do the drops. But it means that he has to keep his eyes closed for 5 minutes each time he puts the drops in. So I've pointed out to him that that gives him 30 minutes a day to pray. But frequently it's necessary for me to lead him by the hand. Sometimes we're in a hotel or an airport or someplace and we have to keep moving. So I have to lead him down the corridor while he's walking with his eyes closed and everybody's looking at him as if, what kind of nut is this? But Lars does not trust me very far. His measure of faith in me is infinitesimal compared to little Walter's in his father. I would suppose that the primary reason is that I have given him many reasons not to trust me, and Walter has never seen any such reasons on the part of his father. But Lars wants visible, tangible evidence. He does not want to walk in blind faith, and he's always accusing me of being tempted to run him up on something. You know, he hangs way back and I'm dragging him along. You know, it's a wide corridor. There's not a person here. There isn't a step here. Believe me. Trust me. He says, you're going to run me up on something. Well, what is trust? Anyway, you may have heard the illustration of the tightrope walker who had strung a tightrope across Niagara Falls and turned to a bystander and asked him, sir, do you believe that I can make it across the falls on that tightrope? And the man said, yes. So then the tightrope walker called for a wheelbarrow and set the wheelbarrow on the rope, and he said, "Now, do you think I can make it across with this wheelbarrow?" And the man said, "Yes." And so the tightrope walker said, "Get in." That would be faith, wouldn't it? It's all very well to say that we believe the promises of God until we actually have to act on them. And then we think he's going to run us up on something if we really step out in faith. Now, trust, number one, for you note takers, is founded on the character of God himself. Fourth chapter of Romans gives the example of that great man of faith, Abraham. Romans 4:13, "It was not through law that Abraham or his posterity was given the promise that the world should be in his inheritance, but through the righteousness that came from faith." Verse 17, "He is the father of us all, as Scripture says, 'I have appointed you to be father of many nations.' This promise, then, was valid before God, the God in whom he put his faith, the God who makes the dead live and summons things that are not yet in existence, as if they already were." Now, I like these vigorous words, verse 18, "When hope seemed hopeless, his faith was such that he became the father of many nations, in agreement with the words which had been spoken to him." Verse 19, "Without any weakening of faith, he contemplated his own body as good as dead, for he was about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb, and never doubted God's promise in unbelief, but strong in faith, gave honor to God in the firm conviction of his power to do what he had promised." Firm conviction of his power to do what he had promised. To me, that's a good enough definition of faith. God can implement his promises. But you remember that God's original promises to Abraham were very broad generalities. "I'm going to make you into a great nation, a great name, and a great blessing." And Abraham took him at his word, obeyed, and left everything behind that had ever been familiar to him, and went out not knowing where, whither. But then we read that there were all kinds of things that happened as a result of God's promise to Abraham. And I want you to ponder this point. When God makes a promise to you, and it looks wonderful, the prospects look great, a great nation, a great name, a great blessing, and you take him up on it, does everything work out as you expect from there on in? I don't suppose it ever does. In my experience, trusting God has invariably meant something much bigger, much more difficult, much more exciting and overwhelming than I could ever have imagined at the beginning. And so much bigger, so much more exciting, so much more overwhelming that I would never have said yes to God if I'd known what I was getting into. Now, does this remind you of any other major decision in life? What about marriage? It is a very exciting prospect, isn't it? It turns out to be quite different than what you imagined. This man that you thought was a prize package turns out to be a surprise package. No matter how well you thought you knew him before you got married, by the next morning, you found out a whole lot of things about him that you didn't really know about. As one of my spiritual mothers, a dear old lady on Cape Cod who lived to be in her 90s, and she'd never married. She was a woman of great wisdom and great understanding of the human frame. And she said to me one time, "Betty dear, we're none of us perfect. Just look for the essentials and skip the rest." And she talked a great deal about death and how much she looked forward to being with the Lord, because she said, "When I get there, there will be no more Dorothy. It's going to be all Jesus." And she just lived in that radiant hope. Well, I want you to be thinking during this talk about the analogies between the will of God and marriage, obedience to God, discipleship, everything that it means to follow him, and the analogy of marriage. Now, it's not an analogy that I thought of. It's one that God himself used all the way through Scripture. He was the bridegroom, and Israel was his bride. In the New Testament, we find Christ as the bridegroom, and the church as his bride. He's the one who does the initiating. He's the one who woos. He calls. He lays down his life for us. He loves us while we were yet sinners. He gives us his name. He gives us his destiny. And he asks for everything. No holds barred. And that's what marriage is about, isn't it? We are not prepared for the intensity of the invasion of our privacy. I often think that when the bride is walking down the aisle, every wedding I've been to, the bride is walking down the aisle with a radiant face, even though she is going to have to make a whole lot of sacrifices. She's leaving her family behind. She's leaving perhaps her town, her state. She's leaving her independence. She's leaving the right to make unilateral decisions. She's giving up her name. She's giving up her privacy. But I've never seen a bride walking down the aisle sobbing because of this list of sacrifices that she's thinking about. The expulsive power of a new affection, that prize package who's waiting for her down there at the altar, has just obliterated all these other things. But marriage turns out to be much bigger, much more comprehensive, much more consuming, much more difficult, much more overwhelming than she could have ever imagined. And she has to learn to trust this man. If she is a Christian wife, she has to trust him in a way that is just mind-boggling to the secular mind, because we are commanded to submit to a sinful man. The Bible doesn't say, wives, submit yourselves to your husbands as long as they're right. Submit yourselves to your husbands as long as they're loving you as Christ loved the church. Submit yourselves to your husbands as long as they're lovable. Submit yourself to your husbands as long as you agree. That would drain the word submission of all meaning, wouldn't it? There's no submission necessary as long as everything's fine and you agree 100% with what he's saying. You don't have to submit. It's when you think that he really doesn't know what he's talking about, that he might be making a very serious mistake, that you have to acknowledge his headship. This man stands in the place of Christ. There's that analogy which was given to us by the Holy Spirit to represent the deepest relationship that we human beings know anything about. The relationship between God and his people is inexpressible. It is ineffable. It is so profound and so mysterious that there is no human language to describe it. But God has used the closest analogy that he could to help us to understand, that of bridegroom and bride. I don't know if any of you are familiar with a book that I've just become aware of. I got it for Christmas. It's a book on marriage to end all books on marriage. We don't need any more. Everything has been said. I was up to here with books on marriage, to tell you the truth, and I haven't read any for years because I got so sick of them all. But here's one that is a total watershed, so you can put down the title. We don't have it here. It's not my book. It's by Mike Mason, and it's called The Mystery of Marriage. But he starts right out in the prologue telling how shocking the intimacy of marriage was to him. And he and his wife visited a monastery on part of their honeymoon, and he immediately is overwhelmed with the feeling that he's made a horrible mistake, that he was meant to be a monk. And he says, love walks straight into your life and stretches itself out on your bed with no clothes on, and from there on your privacy is totally disintegrated, your independence. And he goes through all these things which nobody could possibly be aware of until they get into it, and then it's too late. He says, this person that you didn't think you could ever get, you can't get rid of now. I don't know of any book that deals more candidly and straightforwardly and brutally with all the difficulties that marriage is going to raise, or more gloriously. J.I. Packer writes the introduction, and he says that he's never come across anything with quite the glow. He said, I don't know what other word to use, of this marriage. And he writes in soaring, radiant prose about the glory of marriage. And that's what it is with God, too, isn't it? When we get down in the middle of the difficulties and we can't see the forest for the trees, we forget all about the radiance and the glory that's promised and the promises. And so here was Abraham, having been given this wonderful promise that looks so terrific. A great nation, a great name, a great blessing. And then Israel goes into 400 years of famine and slavery. And Abraham is put to the test again and again and again. When he's 100 years old and his wife is 90, God comes down into the most intimate area of their lives and says, you're going to conceive a son. Does God have a right to invade every atom of our being, every minute of our time, every inch of our space? Who is he? He's God. We turn over how many of the rights? All of them. All the rights. If Jesus Christ is Lord of my life, then he is Lord of every inch of my space, every atom of my being, every area of my life. He knows my thoughts before I do. He knows more about me than I'll ever know about myself. He's already given me a name that I don't know, and nobody's going to know but he and I. That's intimacy, and it requires trust. And in chapter 22 of Genesis, first verse, it says, the time came when God put Abraham to the test, as if Abraham hadn't already been tested. But these are the words, Genesis 22:1, the time came when God put Abraham to the test. Abraham he called, and Abraham replied, here I am. God said, take your son, your only son whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah. There you shall offer him as a sacrifice on one of the hills, which I will show you. So Abraham sat down and had a pity party for himself. So Abraham called up 39 of his closest friends and shared his feelings. Doesn't say that. Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his ass, took with him two of his men and his son Isaac. He split the firewood and set out for the place of which God had spoken. We're not told a syllable about how Abraham felt about this. I think we can guess how a father would feel about not just a son, but the most beloved son and the one through whom God had told him he was going to fulfill these wonderful promises. And so from those broad generalities, which were so thrilling, God comes right down to the terrible particulars and says, I want your son. Put him on the altar and burn him up. That's what a sacrifice is about. And we don't know what Abraham felt. We don't know anything he said, but we do know what he did. He got up early in the morning and started obeying. And he had 3 days, remember, to reconsider. 3 days to decide that he really didn't want any part of this. But the decision had been made long before that, that he was going to obey God, regardless of what he said. And although the will of God now was turning out to be something very different from what he had imagined, and something much bigger, overwhelming, he kept on following and obeying. And he actually raised the knife. He built the altar. He arranged the wood. He bound his son Isaac. He laid him on the altar on top of the wood, stretched out his hand, took the knife to kill his son. His obedience was perfect in the sight of God. But as you remember, God did not require that final sacrifice. Now, Abraham could not have done that if his trust was founded on the way he thought things were going to turn out. And nowadays, there are an awful lot of people who imagine that they have faith because they think God is going to do such and such a thing. They say, I have faith to believe that so-and-so is going to be healed, faith to believe that God is going to pay this debt, faith to believe that God's going to give us a new house. And, of course, God can heal the person. He can pay the debt. He can give you a new house. But he might not have that in mind. He might have something else in mind. And if he does something else, what happens to your faith? I've been through a good many experiences in my own life which were not on my agenda. Experiences which were exactly the opposite from what I had expected of the will of God. You can be sure that when Jim went in to attempt to take the gospel to the Alka Indians, I and the other wives prayed for physical safety. We knew what the dangers were. We prayed that God would preserve them, be a shield, and bring them back safely. And God allowed them, after they had trusted him to be their shield and their defender, to be speared to death. The great generality of being a missionary, and a missionary to an unreached tribe, comes right down to bleeding to death on the point of a spear. The terrible particulars. Time comes when God puts you to the test. It's all very well for you to trust me about these broad generalities that look so pleasant and desirable. But will you trust me if I put my finger on your child? Will you trust me if I touch the deepest longing of your heart? Will you trust me if I sweep away something into which you have poured your life? Trust has to be founded not on the outcome that you are expecting, but on the character of God. And that's what this passage in Romans 4 tells us. Abraham believed God. When hope seemed hopeless, his faith was such that he became the father of many nations. When he was told that he was to have a son, when he was way past that age and his wife had been barren for years, he looked at the facts and staggered not at the promise of God. So the second thing that I want us to recognize under this heading, learning to trust, is learning to relinquish. Abraham was willing initially to relinquish houses and lands and family, as the bride is willing, because of the expulsive power of this new affection, to relinquish houses and lands and geography and independence and her name and a whole lot of other things. She gives it up because she sees a prospect which is eminently desirable. And Abraham didn't know where he was going. He didn't know what was going to happen, but he really knew God. And his faith rested in who God was, just as little Walters did in that car wash. He wasn't worried about what was going to happen as long as his father was there. But we must learn to relinquish. If our trust is founded on the character of God, then he's going to say, and what if I take this? And what if I take that? And what if you lose this? Will you trust me? In my very first year as a missionary, I had some of these lessons in relinquishment. God took away the informant, who was the one man in the world that could help me with the language that I was trying to reduce to writing, the one man who could speak Spanish and that Indian language. There was nobody else that could do that. He was murdered after I had, with a great deal more difficulty than I would have if he had lived, after I had succeeded in reducing the language to writing, then all of my language materials were stolen. We prayed, of course, that God would get that suitcase full of language materials back, because there weren't any copies in those days. We didn't have Xerox and we didn't have tape recorders. God knew where that suitcase was. He knew it wasn't going to do anybody any good. And guess what? We never got that back. The will of God turned out to be quite different from what I had imagined. I had a lot of graven images. I had an image of what God was supposed to be and do. I had a very neat picture of how God helps people, and he had given me the verse in Isaiah 50, verse 7, the Lord God will help me, therefore shall I not be confounded. Therefore have I set my face like a flint, and I know that I shall not be ashamed. Kind of a funny way to help a servant, isn't it? To take away the one informant that could do a job that nobody else could do. Very strange to let the work of a year be stolen. But my faith had to rest at that point in the character of God, because there really wasn't anything else left. Everything in you that can be shaken is going to be shaken, I promise you, if you will follow Jesus Christ the whole way. Don't be surprised. Jesus said, in the world you will have tribulation. But cheer up. I have overcome the world. Your faith has to lay hold on that promise, not just on the reality of the terrible facts of your life. And back to this passage in Romans, Abraham looked at the facts. He was not an optimist who looks at everything through rose-colored glasses and ignores or suppresses the data that doesn't happen to fit into his neat little picture. He looked at the facts. He was as good as dead. His wife was certainly as good as dead as far as reproducing is concerned. And staggered not at the promise of God. In other words, faith operates on two levels, the visible and the invisible. I lost my informant. I lost my language materials. Case closed. Those were the facts. What does it mean? Why does God allow this to happen? He doesn't explain it to me. He says, trust me. You don't have to know when we're going to get out of this car wash. Trust me. I'm here. I love you. I've got the whole world in my hands. Let go. Relinquish. You know, we're clutching with white knuckles things that we are determined that nobody is going to touch, nobody is going to take away from me. This dream, this hope, this project, this person, this youth. And if you look in the mirror in the morning and wonder what's becoming of that youth, it takes you about three times as long to look about half as good as it did last week. You know, I talk to a lot of women who are terrified of old age. And I hope that that's another lesson that I learned through my mother. She grew old gracefully. And I refuse to try to hide my age. In fact, I mean, if I refused to tell you my age, you'd probably think I was 10 years older than I am. And I would say, well, who do I think I'm kidding? You know, I'll tell you that I'm 60, so you won't think I'm 70. But if you think you can kid somebody, then of course you're only kidding one person in the world, and that's yourself. But this may seem like a trivial matter, and yet what a thoroughly worldly attitude Christian women have taken toward old age. They refuse to be called grandma or granny or whatever. I love being called granny, but I hear a lot of people who refuse those names because it signifies something that they really deplore. Let it go. Relinquishment is part of trusting God. Relinquish it. Let it go. I wrote a book, a novel called No Graven Image, in which I tried to say in fictional form what I had been saying in non-fictional form about the lessons of faith and the meaning of worship that God had laid before me in my own missionary experience. The novel is about a missionary woman. And the reason I entitled it No Graven Image was because I realized how often God had had to smash images that I had. My image, as I mentioned, of who He was, my image of what missionary work was going to be, my image of myself as a missionary. I had imagined that I was going to be known as the apostle to the Colorado Indians of Western Ecuador, because I was going to translate the language, reduce the language to writing, and translate the Bible for these people. I didn't get to do that. I did a lot of language work in the Quechua language, totally unrelated to Colorado. And for reasons that I can't go into this morning, that went down the drain. And then I started at the bottom rung of another language ladder, and humanly speaking, that too turned out to be fruitless as far as I could tell. Other people have done the language work. I was only there with them for 2 years, and I can't explain all what I'm saying this morning except to say that these were experiences of relinquishment, of giving up the images and saying, Lord, teach me, show me, help me to pin my faith 100% in who You are. I want to trust You unconditionally and totally. Abraham looked at the fact and staggered not at the promise of God. Faith deals with two levels. That is point number three. I haven't been clear enough here. The first one is learning to trust. Second one, learning to relinquish. And number three, faith deals with two levels. Now, if we omit either of those levels, if we omit the facts, for example, then our faith is nothing but sentiment. If we omit the promises, then faith collapses. But we need to remember that God has different ways of fulfilling His will than we imagined. Marriage is wonderful. I have been tremendously blessed in three marriages. The first two quite brief. The third one has lasted more than 9 years already. But it's different. It's very different than what I had imagined. So we married people certainly don't want to disillusion the younger people and say, oh, if you had any idea what you were getting into. You know, I have had people talk like that. I remember when I lived in Ecuador with a white Ecuadorian family, and it was not a very happy home. And again, the lady would say to me in Spanish, Señorita, don't ever get married. Which was very sad to me that she felt that way. But the will of God is going to be bigger. It's going to be more overwhelming. It's going to invade everything. But in the end, there's glory. Suffering and glory are invariably linked together in Scripture. Jesus said, if you suffer with me, you will also reign with me. And in this book that I referred to, The Mystery of Marriage, he points out that it is in the very weaknesses, in the very conflicts, in the very relinquishments of marriage that we learn the true meaning of love in all its glory, its radiance, and its beauty. May God help us to trust him, to pin our faith entirely on his character, to learn to let go, and to keep our eyes not just on the facts, but also on that invisible level where the promises are fulfilled. God bless you.